The first reading this morning comes from Martin Gardner's book, The Night is Large, written in 1995. This is from an essay on religion called Surprise. Mr. Gardner, a trustworthy skeptic, and I had a brief letter correspondence a few years back, which concluded with him sending me a copy of a novel he wrote that starred a Unitarian Universalist minister. He's very amused. In an admirable essay on the art of teaching science, Lewis Thomas proposes that the best way to interest young people in science is to teach not only what is known, but also what is unknown. There should be, and he's quoting Lewis Thomas here, there should be courses dealing with ignorance systematically, courses in informed bewilderment. Young minds should be told that every important advance that has come in looking like an answer has turned sooner or later, usually sooner, into a question. The hard facts have softened, melted away, and vanished under the pressure of new hard facts. And the game is just beginning. The second reading this morning is a bit longer. It's going to be for two voices. This is from Barbara Holmes, whose fascinating book, Race and the Cosmos, written in 2002, I've quoted from before. Dr. Holmes teaches ethics and African-American religious studies at Memphis Theological Seminary.
Location affects perspective. Where we are affects how we see things. We can't view the whole universe or its component parts from where we are. We are as embedded in the cosmic life as we are in daily events. Solutions to issues of race and identity can't be the triumph of one perspective over another. Notwithstanding the balance argument, we cannot know from personal and necessarily biased perspectives the needs of the other unless relationships remain intact.
This is not to deny the horror of historical events that don't seem to have more than one perspective. There can be no upside to the Jewish, Native American, or African Holocaust. Well, we have the responsibility to say, never again. The failure to admit our limited human perspectives leaves us open to the frightening potential of a repeat. We don't know the explicit contours of radical evil. To pretend that we do means that we won't recognize reappearances in new configurations. Once we are wedded to the image of evil as hooded Knight Rider or global corporate invader, we are tricked by the desire for solid answers. Every time we have projected outcomes, we have been surprised.
Integration seemed to be a concept that had easily predictable consequences. People of all colors would live and work together in peace and harmony. Racism would end, and opportunities would be available to all who wanted to participate in the dream. The reality is that racism has become cunning. It's not dead. A permanent underclass has developed among some ethnic groups. The racism is dead narrative negates their reality. Native Americans are still forgotten and marginalized, beset by health problems and decades of cultural annihilation. Yet the rhetoric of the casino successes of a few tribes obliterates this reality. African Americans occupy some of the highest governmental positions and command huge salaries as public figures. But the songs of success coming from the few have drowned out the bloody reality of gang members and starving children.
From where we stand, we cannot see. Whether we touch an elephant's tail or its trunk determines our description of the animal. If we base our conservation efforts on the way the tail feels, or assume that our tactile information is the only reality, our conservation efforts will probably fail. If our policies on race are developed from limited perspectives as we grasp the elephant's tail, they will serve only our own purposes. We only know in part. We need to repeat this mantra often, as it will keep us humble and alert.
This past Thursday, I, Mr. Stay up till 2 in the morning and get up after 9 every morning, got up at 7 a.m. to attend a clergy meeting at COSAI, our nationally praised science museum here in Columbus. Very soon, they are hosting a show called Body Works and the Brain. This exhibit consists of the body parts of real human beings, deceased, which have been somehow plasticized so that the various organs that keep us alive right now can actually be seen as they actually are. There was a show similar to this which went through Columbus, I think, around 5 years ago. But it was controversial because the bodies that had been plasticized came from prisoners in Southeast Asia who did not give their permission to serve as an exhibit after death. I knew that, and I did not go to see that exhibit. But this exhibit is made up of the bodies of men and women who have freely signed papers, many of them, to donate their bodies to science and to this particular exhibit. The only exception in this exhibit consists of plasticized embryos and fetuses, which come from anatomy departments in medical schools, and which, interestingly enough, somehow preserved in formaldehyde, are about 100 years old. The very gracious and thoughtful staff of the museum engaged those of us who gathered there, a Unitarian Universalist minister like me, several people out of the Jewish and Christian communities. They asked us about ethical issues we might have around this, or what people in our congregations might think. We talked freely about our concerns. We wanted to make sure that there was an opportunity to process feelings. I did see a version of this exhibit in Chicago a number of years ago. My godson, Adam, took me to see it when I was visiting him. And I did have an emotional reaction. It was an amazing exhibit, and I learned a great deal, and I always was thinking, these people were once alive. These body parts once throbbed with life. And I had a feeling. And I'm not ashamed of that at all. And so even though I learned a great deal, I had to recognize that my whole reaction was both emotional as well as intellectual. One of the things I brought up at the meeting on Thursday was this. I said, I'm a male human being. I cannot bear a child in my body. I cannot suffer the unexpected loss of a pregnancy. I cannot feel postpartum depression. I cannot experience any of the various gynecological realities that are only known to women and felt by women. I suggested, and the other clergy there agreed at once, that they must take special care in how the gynecological exhibits depicting development inside the womb are presented. They assured us that they had already thought about this thoroughly. These exhibits are going to be in a separate room, and no one will just stumble upon this particular exhibit. They will have to deliberately choose to go inside. And there will be words on the outside to let them know exactly what's on the inside. While driving here later that morning to lead the senior worship service, I reflected on what I had said in that meeting. And this is what I came to realize with growing clarity. And remember, all theological thinking is simply reflecting on experience. When I say that I think that something is true, I always have to make sure that I never assume that what I say is true must be true for all other human beings without exception. My truth, after all, is male truth. My truth is Detroit in the 1950s truth, provincial Emilian Italian American truth, someone raised in pre-Second Vatican Council Roman Catholic truth, someone with an alcoholic brother truth, 63-year-old truth, gay male truth, visual artist truth, 33 years as a Unitarian Universalist minister truth, diabetic truth, political leftist truth, person who has lived in many places truth, somewhat well-traveled truth. These are my truths. Yours are undeniably different from mine. But pointedly, because of what I said about the exhibit, it's important for me to admit that I cannot feel the feelings many women feel as they face gynecological issues I will never face. My truth will always be just my truth, and everyone else's truth will remain their own. Like me, if they're honest, they may have to revise what that truth is throughout their lives. For no one can know the whole truth about everything all by themselves. New information is always going to come into us because we are in relationship with other people with different truths. It's no more possible for me to know the whole truth about anything than I can wave a stick with only one end. When anyone claims such knowledge, I know the whole truth. I know the truth for everyone. They have put something partial as universal, which is something the Hebrew scriptures consistently refer to as idolatry. Our own Unitarian Universalist principles in the sources section warn us, and I quote, against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Prophets from an earlier age, like Jeremiah or Isaiah, would simply have said that such an idolater is someone who cannot see past his or her own real limitations. Now, the story you heard earlier of the elephant interpreted by people who cannot actually see past their limitations, their blindfolds, is a very old story. It's found in many versions. I was surprised, actually, at how many versions it has in various cultures. Those involving people born blind, those involving people walking around on a moonless night, and those, like you heard this morning, wearing blindfolds. There is no version found in the Hindu, Buddhist, Jain scriptures, which can be proven to be the original story of the elephant and the children, and of which all other are simply variations. There's even a European version of the story, although in this case, India was clearly the seed for that story. Now, the story can be interpreted in many ways, to be sure. I have been amazed at the variety of messages various cultures have found in it. But this morning, I'd like to dive off the board into the deep pool created by Barbara Holmes in the lengthy second reading. She interprets the story in her own unique way. From where we stand, we cannot see, she writes. Whether we touch the elephant's tail or its trunk determines our description of the animal. Someone touching the trunk will feel something or will describe the animal differently from someone touching the ear or the tusk. But then she unpacks what that means as far as social reality goes. If we base our conservation efforts on the way the tail feels, or assume that our tactile information is the only reality, our conservation efforts are probably going to fail. If our policies on race are developed from limited perspectives as we grasp the elephant's tail, they're only going to end up serving our own purposes. We only know in part. We need to repeat this mantra often, because doing so will keep us humble and alert. We only know in part. She's referring to the anonymous first century poem quoted by Paul of Tarsus in his letter to the Corinthians, the famous love poem often read at weddings. But the esteemed science writer Lewis Thomas suggests something quite similar, according to Martin Gardner. Gardner intersperses Thomas's actual words throughout his text. The best way to interest young people in science is to teach not only what is known, but also that which is unknown. There should be courses dealing systematically with ignorance and informed bewilderment. What I get from all this is that we know some things, but not most things, and certainly not all things. What we don't know unites us more than what we know. What we don't know unites us more than what we know. Oh, yeah, mortality unites us. That we all exist in this universe unites us. But not knowing everything unites us all the more. Under all the tangles of modern life, the economy, the relentless election commercials we have in our state because it's cursed to be a swing state, the changes that come in traffic patterns with Columbus Highway construction, the ups and downs in our own family life and in the lives of our friends, rovers on Mars, riots overseas, all of these things tangle in our minds, to quote Robert Bolt. And sometimes it's hard to go forward when we feel that we are caught in the muddle of the middle of that tangle. Yet because of the precious unity of not knowing, which underlies that tangle, we have every reason to go forward, to serve the common good. Perhaps, in fact, those of us who are Unitarian Universalists or folks who are visiting here this morning who feel similarly are especially well matched to this task. For each of us is part of this religious community this morning, which takes as its identity the place where you can share your own truth and listen to other truths, and learn from the conversation, and still make a caring community, even though the truths are completely different from each other. We strive, in other words, to be a non-idolatrous community, with no one, including the ordained ministers or revered lay members, proclaiming anything once and for all for everybody. We value our knowledge because it is provisional and partial and means something only as it engages with others with different knowledge in community. Truth, you see, is alive, not dead. Again, to quote Barbara Holmes, location affects perspective. Where we are affects how we see things. We can't view the whole universe or its component parts from where we are. We are as embedded in cosmic life as we are in daily events. Solutions to issues of race and identity can't be the triumph of one perspective over another. Notwithstanding the balance argument, we cannot know from personal and necessarily biased perspective, the needs of the other, unless our relationships remain intact. Truth is only truth if we remain in relationship, if we work together, share together, and are vulnerable toward each other. Otherwise, I don't trust it. The relationships have to remain intact despite our not knowing, despite our different understandings of what we do know, despite even our wounds and our mistakes. As the vision of the Jewish high holiday of Yom Kippur reminded us this last week. If you do go to the exhibit on the human body at COSI that I talked about at the beginning of this sermon, and I truly understand the feelings will be too strange for some of you to do that. Makes perfect sense, I understand. You'll find an even more compelling illustration of what an anonymous first century poet, a famous skeptic like Martin Gardner, a revered science writer like Lewis Thomas, an honored science fiction writer like Ursula K. Le Guin, and a brilliant theologian like Barbara Holmes all agree on. There at that exhibit, you'll see that truth is no more possible alone than a human heart or human hand can live on its own without the rest of the body connected to it. Truth is no more possible to remain truth once and for all as it is than a body can remain a child once and for all. So learn well, unlearn well, be as unafraid of what you don't know as you are of what you know, and for goodness sake, let go of that elephant's tail.